So we've talked about damage control resuscitation. We've talked about intubation, vascular access, and hemostasis. Now let's turn our attention to head-to-toe pearls and pitfalls and controversies. What we're going to do is we're going to present some quick cases and talk about head, neck, spine, chest, abdo-pelvis, and extremity trauma, and just try and get some take-home points from each of those. So the first case is a 55-year-old man who presents to your emergency department from the local hockey arena where he was knocked unconscious after being boarded. Now, for those non-Canadian listeners, getting boarded is something that actually happened to me when I was a kid. And come to think of it, maybe that's why I can never remember where my car keys are. Anyhow, what happens is you get body checked from behind without warning, and usually it's by some Goliath-looking monster on skates, and your head slams into the boards at a million miles an hour. And so this patient who got boarded comes in with normal vital signs, but a GCS of 7. Now, head injured patients in particular require a whole other set of considerations compared to the non-head injured trauma patient. Let's talk a little bit about how we can minimize increased ICP, anticonvulsant prophylaxis, therapeutic hypothermia. So first, we talked a little bit about intubating trauma patients at the beginning, but we didn't talk about using lidocaine and fentanyl for pretreatment for head-injured patients. What's your take on lidocaine and fentanyl as pretreatment before RSI in head-injured patients?
I don't know that the literature is all that supportive of giving lidocaine. I mean, I think we do it because, again, it's relatively benign. I think if you look at the original studies, it was patients in the ICU with intracranial pressure monitors in place, and they basically went around and gave them lidocaine or not and jiggled their ET tubes and saw the response in the ICP. So I'm not sure it's exactly the same population that we're dealing with, but do I give it? Probably half the time I do. If I've got a couple of minutes before I'm actually going to intubate the patient, I might consider giving the lidocaine. Neuroprotective agents such as fentanyl or benzodiazepines, for that matter, or propofol, if you want. I'm not sure, again, about the literature, but I certainly do try to give the patient something, particularly if they're a little bit higher GCS, just for if they have any awareness. I want to try to take the edge off before I start doing a rapid sequence for them.
Now, how about minimizing increased intracranial pressure? What are some of the easy things we can do in the emergency department to help minimize raised ICP?
Simple things, like if you can get the head of the bed, tilt the whole bed up 30 degrees so you've got gravity working on your side. If you have focal neurologic findings, like you've got a blown pupil or you've got hemiplegia or there's good evidence or some strong clinical evidence that you've got a focal lesion in the brain, I'm not so sure that giving mannitol and hyperventilating to a moderate level are bad things. They're only buying you time. So we're not going to hyperventilate the patients for, 12 hours. We're going to do it to a PCO2 of maybe 35 or so and then get the scan. And once they need a definitive surgical procedure, they get it done and then you don't hyperventilate them anymore. I know there's a risk of, vasoconstriction causing worse ischemic injury to the brain, but I still think I'd argue that moderate hyperventilation is still indicated for short term.
So our nurses do give mannitol, and I think that's fine. I think there's really little evidence of any harm. I'd sort of take the opposite stance of the hyperventilation for a couple reasons. So I think it's not well studied. There's not good evidence to say one way or the other, but the respiratory alkalosis causing vasoconstriction, I think it's probably a real thing. I'd also argue that most patients, when they get intubated, now there's literature on this, that they probably get hyperventilated anyway. When somebody's bagging them, everybody bags too much. So their PCO2 is probably 30 to 35 anyway. And that's my argument against hyperventilating them even more, because then you're probably getting into the range where you're getting the cerebral vasoconstriction.
So bottom line for hyperventilation, you can consider it just as a very short temporizing measure, and that you wouldn't want to hyperventilate down to like a PCO2 of 20. You want to target for about a PCO2 of 35.
If you're going to do it, I think that's probably the limit.
I would agree, yeah. And I would argue, again, to be checking. And if it's going to be for prolonged, you're transferring a patient. I mean, I'd get your neurosurgeon on the phone and see if they recommend it. And if you do, you want to be really careful you don't over-hyperventilate, which I think is quite common.
I'll just reiterate the point that it's patients that you have a pretty strong clinical suspicion that they're going to have a space-occupying lesion. It's not for all comers, diffuse axonal injury or anything like that. If you've got some clinical suggestion, the patient's got a focal finding,
Like if the patient's coning in front of you and you got to get them straight to the OR, you can hyperventilate them a little bit on the way.
Yeah, blown pupil or hemi creases.
Okay. In terms of anticonvulsant prophylaxis, do you guys routinely give Dilantin or any other drug for that matter for anticonvulsant prophylaxis, or do you only treat seizures if they occur?
So for sure, if there's a seizure and a head injury, and our surgeons at our facility are suggesting that we do give them Dilantin. And they're actually quite liberal in their use of Dilantin. If there is a bleed on the CT of any sort, they will prophylax them for a week with Dilantin. If they're seizure-free for that week, then they'll stop it. So traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage, intracerebral bleed, subdural, anything, they just give it for a week, and if they don't seize, then they stop.
And do they recommend starting it in the emergency department?
Yeah, if we find something on CT, we will start it, yes. Or if the patient's had a documented seizure.
Okay, and in terms of controlling agitation in the head-injured patient, do you sort of liberally use benzos? Do you prefer Haldol? Do you use both?
Benzodiazepines we know are safe, period. Propofol drips are easy. You can use fentanyl and midazolam if their pressure is not a worry and you want to do that combination, whatever you're comfortable with. But I think bottom line is we know benzodiazepines are not harmful. Some theoretical risk that Haldol will lower the seizure threshold. I'm not sure how real that is. Go with what you know, and benzodiazepines are safe. That's what I use.
You just got to be a little careful because then they can get so sedated they start, you know, lose their airway. The good thing about Haldol, they don't seem to lose their airway as much.
Watch out for respiratory depression with high doses of benzos in the non-intubated patient.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about therapeutic hypothermia for head injury. The big question is, does it really improve neurologic outcome for traumatic brain injury? And should we be starting it in the emergency department?
So that's a good question. First of all, you got to look at isolated head injury because the last thing you want to do is cool a trauma patient that has multiple injuries and just make things worse. I have to admit, our neurosurgeons are not recommending that we initiate hypothermia in our head injured patients right now.
The Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine did a review that showed support for prophylactic hypothermia to 32 to 34 degrees in patients severely head injured, so those below a GCS of 8. And they showed that it did decrease mortality and improve neurologic recovery. So I'm not sure why it hasn't been adopted.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't. I mean, one thing, I imagine those were isolated head injury patients, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Because Mike's right, the polytraumatized patient, you worry, like what we talked about before, hypothermia and coagulopathy. So you'd have to sort of really just pick a focused group of isolated head, which with a really low GCS, that's not a lot of our patients.
Maybe it's just something to consider, to think about. When you have a patient with an isolated severe head injury, it might be something you might want to speak to your neurosurgeon about, your ICU people about, to see whether...
Exactly. I was just about to say is get your neurosurgeon on the phone, because if they're not a believer in that, then you probably don't want to start cooling them and then...
So you can ask them about the Octoplex at the same time as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Dilantin.
Yeah. Getting away from the major head injury, for patients with really small bleeds who come walking in with a GCS of 15 or 14, who got a CT of their head for whatever reason, for those patients with tiny bleeds, do those patients all require admission? If they all do require admission, do they all need a CT head repeated? And if they do need a CT head repeated, when should that CT head be repeated?
So this kind of goes back to the Canadian CT head rules and what were deemed as insignificant injuries in that study that, you know, you had your high and moderate risk factors, and then they had a group of patients that had CTs done but found minimal things like, quote-unquote, a subdural slick, so a very small subdural, some small amount of traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage, those types of patients. That always made me a little bit nervous because they have some anatomic finding on CAT scan, yet they are normal clinically, the GCS of 15. I always sort of, with a bit of hesitancy, would say they have no significant injury. So I would probably still get a neurosurgical opinion, to be honest with you. And there's many other things to consider, too. The reliability of the patient. Do they have a place to go to with some supervision? Is the patient elderly? Again, are they anticoagulated or on any other antiplatelet drugs, et cetera? So I think there's a number of things to take into consideration. But the times I have sought neurosurgical opinions on those minor, quote-unquote, injuries, most of the time, if they're reliable and all, they'll send them home. I think if you're in the periphery as well, this is probably a patient that you keep in your department overnight or admit to the hospital for a day or two, do serial exams, make sure they're not deteriorating.
Sure. So let's say you admit them to you decide for whatever reason the neurosurgeon suggested it, admit them to your own hospital. So you admit them, then do you need to do a repeat CT or do you just watch them clinically?
I think you can rely on your clinical exam, and
I think so too. I mean, if in 24 hours they're walking around, you know, eating McDonald's hamburger, they're not going to get operated on. So you could argue, why do the scan? At our site, I mean, I think they tend to scan them a lot more 24 to 48 hours later. I think it partially they feel safer and better letting them go home at that point.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our patient population at St. Mike's isn't the most reliable, and so they're not going to have a good, safe place to go. So I think that's maybe one of the issues why we maybe do that more.
I think the literature bears that out as well. There was a big Swedish study that looked at patients who were admitted with a GCS near 15, whether repeating a CAT scan changed anything, and it didn't. Except maybe give them a bit more cancer.
Yeah. One small aside, and you don't have to be completely normal to have a GCS of 15. And so you can be perseverating, you still know where you are and who you are and what time it is and what place you're in, but you keep asking the same question, how to get here? What happened to me? What happened to me? So you're not completely lucid, normal, but you have a GCS of 15. And I think those are the patients that I think, you know, a documented GCS of 15, but you're still a bit worried about them. And that might be a case where maybe I'll rescan the patient. So my point is GCS 15 is not equal completely normal mental status.
Here's a quick review of the head injured patient. First, for pre-treatment medication before RSI of the head injured patient, you can consider giving lidocaine if you have time. Remember, it has to be given at least 3 minutes before the rest of your RSI. And the evidence for lidocaine is not great in terms of improved outcomes or neurologic recovery in the head injured patient. Fentanyl has some pretty good evidence that it may help in the head injured patient. So that is an option in terms of pre-treatment for your RSI. In terms of induction agent, most ED docs use either etomidate or ketamine for the trauma patient as their induction agent of choice because they generally do not cause hypotension. Please listen to episode 8 on airway controversies for more details on induction agents. How about raised ICP? Well, the simple thing you can do is raise the head of the bed about 30 degrees. And in terms of when to hyperventilate the patient, remember you should only be hyperventilating the patient if they are coning, or if they have a blown pupil, or if they have a hemiparesis or a hardcore focal finding. And you should only be hyperventilating to a PCO2 of about 35. Now, Dr. McKinnon argued that most patients are bagged too fast anyhow, and they're probably being hyperventilated anyways. So the important part is to monitor the PCO2. You can also give mannitol or hypertonic saline to buy you time before the patient gets to the OR. Remember, be careful not to overventilate the patient because that can cause respiratory alkalosis, which causes cerebral vasoconstriction and worsens outcomes. In terms of anticonvulsant prophylaxis, if the patient has a seizure, use Dilantin. Most neurosurgeons suggest seizure prophylaxis for patients with major head injury, and they give Dilantin for 1 week. That's usually started in the emergency department. How about controlling agitation in the head injured patient? Well, benzodiazepines are generally very safe, but beware of respiratory depression. Haldol may lower the seizure threshold, but it tends to have less respiratory depression compared with benzodiazepines. What about therapeutic hypothermia for isolated head injury? Well, there was a Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine review in 2010 which showed that therapeutic hypothermia in the isolated head-injured patient with a GCS of less than 8 did decrease mortality and improve neurological outcome, but it doesn't seem to be the standard at present. The best bet is probably to speak to your neurosurgeon and also to remember that hypothermia would be detrimental to the patient who is a multi-trauma patient who is bleeding somewhere else. What about that patient with minor head injury who is walking around with a GCS of 15, who has a tiny little subdural or a tiny bit of subarachnoid blood? Do they require admission? Well, most of these patients probably do require admission, but it depends on many things. whether they're taking anticoagulants or antiplatelets, how reliable they are. Regardless, you should probably get a neurosurgical opinion. If you do admit these patients, do serial physical examinations at a very minimum, with the option of repeating the CT scan for those who you are worried about. There has been some evidence that shows that patients with a GCS of 15 with a tiny little bleed whose physical exams are normal repeatedly do not require a repeat CT head. Next, we're going to move on to trauma of the neck. When you awake, you will remember everything. Let's move on to neck and spine. First, let's talk a little bit about C-spine imaging. It seems like there's been more and more use of CT for clearing of the C-spine in trauma patients in the last 15 years or so. There's been some controversy of how best to clear the C-spine. Is there a role for plain films in the multi-trauma patient for the C-spine? And what would it be? And which patients need a CT? And then which patients need an MRI?
So, look, I think the key point you say is multi-trauma patients, and that immediately sets apart the group of patients that are eligible to enter the algorithm for the Canadian C-spine rule. So, I'll assume we eliminate those patients because those are minor mechanisms with minor injuries and patients that, you know, I think you can still apply the C-spine rule to and do plain films. Most of the patients that we're seeing in the trauma bay are multi-system injuries, and you're probably going to get a CT of their head in most scenarios if there's any sort of indication of head injury. And it's routine that we would just continue on and do the neck to continue. So it's very minimal addition of radiation. Lots of studies to show that you're going to miss a lot of injuries on plain films in those populations, and that there's very little miss rate with the CTs these days for significant C-spine injuries. So if you're going to go to the CT scanner for another reason, I'd probably do their neck as well.
In that obtunded patient who you can't get a history from and you can't examine their C-spine properly, for those patients with a negative CT, do you need to go on to MRI to clear their spine?
So there was a good, decent-sized study that came out that said if you have a completely normal CT scan, and this is not just no fracture, but no soft tissue swelling, no gaps in where the ligaments are, things like that, then their incidence of having a ligamentous injury is really, really low. So they came to the conclusion that those patients could, this collar could safely be removed, even though you can't do a proper sort of have the patient flex and extend their neck and look left and right like we normally like to do. So the feeling was those patients could safely have their C-spine collar removed, C-spine precautions. I mean, keep in mind, they're in an ICU bed, they're obtunded. Nobody's flopping their neck around anyway, so actually their neck is staying relatively still. So if there's the occasional patient that actually has a ligament injury that they didn't see on CT, you're probably not going to cause much harm anyway. When they do wake up, you're going to sort out that they're still having a lot of neck pain, and I think that's the whole reasoning behind it.
Okay, and what about the T and L spine? Are there rules of who we should be x-raying and who we shouldn't? I guess that would be the first question, is who needs imaging in the first place? And then the second question would be for patients who are getting a CT of the belly and or chest anyhow, is it good enough to do reconstructions on their CT abdomen and chest, or do you have to do dedicated spine CTs? So let's start with the question of who needs to be imaged.
So it's a good question. I guess I'd start off by saying T and L spine injuries, like fractures that need operative management, are actually relatively uncommon. Probably L spine are more common, but T spine injuries, they're well protected by the ribs. They're relatively uncommon. So, of course, in the old days, before we would scan these, we would examine. We'd actually see if there's any tenderness, do a rectal exam and see if there's any neurologic abnormalities. And then if you're worried, you'd do a plain film. And then if you saw an abnormality in the plain film, then you'd move on, like you'd CT that. And we'd even actually CT just the area that they had the injury, or that you suspected the injury on. That was kind of the old style. Then as CT scanners got better and more people got scanned, now when you do a CT scan of the thorax abdo-pelvis, you can do recons of the T and L spine. So essentially get probably better than an x-ray without any extra radiation for the patient. So that's what everybody started doing. Now my one little problem with that is what's eventually evolved is we used to do a lot of CT abdomens and feel that we didn't need to do a CT scan of the thorax. because you could see what you needed to on the chest x-ray, which was, is their aorta look okay, and do they have a hemopneumothorax? Nowadays, it's just the whole concept of the pan scan has come on, where you're doing head right to the pelvis. Everybody's getting a thorax CT scan. We're probably underappreciating how much radiation they're getting, how much extra. Again, we might not find this out for 20, 30 years. So now it's become standard. You have to clear the T-spine by doing a CT scan of the thorax. And a lot of patients that we probably wouldn't have done the CT scan otherwise. So I guess I'm sort of deviating a little bit going on this bandwagon, but I think that sort of so-called clear the T-spine, we're doing a lot more CT of the thorax that we didn't need to or we wouldn't have done before.
We'll get back
for a rare injury that rarely needs an operative management.
I'll get back to the spine in a second, but I think the reason that we are doing a lot more chests is because we're getting some surprises in the mediastinum in rare patients that have, you know, pelvic fracture, and you find they've got an aortic injury as well. So, you know, it's almost a protocol where if you're going to do an abdomen, you're going to do a chest as well, just to make sure that everything looks okay. And the bonus is you get the spine done. I think if you have a relatively low energy mechanism, or you've got an isolated finding clinic like a tender thoracolumbar junction, that's perhaps a time where I do a plain film. So a guy slips and falls on his buttocks and he's got low back pain, or he falls like 5 feet and lands on his bum and he's got some low back pain, that's probably where I'd do a plain film first if he's tender, and then move on to a CT. I wouldn't necessarily need to scan his abdomen or his chest for that. But so I think given the mechanisms of injury and, like you say, focal tenderness, those would be indications for plain films. Realizing the fact, though, that a lot of the times, if you really are worried about it, the plain films are inadequate and the images aren't very good, and you end up CT scanning these patients anyway for a highly suspicious patient.
You do your plain films first, and then if you're still worried about the patient, then you'd go on to a dedicated TRL spine. And the multiply injured patient who's really sick, you're going to be scanning their abdo and probably their abdo-pelvis and probably their thorax as well, and the recons are good enough.
Yes, then you can just forego plain films.
So let's say you've got a patient who you believe has a spinal cord injury. Is there good evidence for using steroids like methylprednisolone for patients with a known spinal cord injury?
The practice definitely says not to. In any case, it's never given. There's sort of the famous, I guess the history of that was a case, and I think it was California, where somebody had a bad spinal injury and a bad outcome, and they sued and they got a huge settlement. I think it was $20 million or some 30 million ridiculous settlement. And then about, you know, 15 years later, the literature saying it's no benefit and potentially some harm.
I'll refer you to an article. It's by a Canadian neurosurgeon named Hurlburt from Calgary, and I think it was in 2001. The history of this is the NASIS trials 1, 2, and 3. He does a really great job of doing a critical appraisal of all the papers that studied methylprednisolone, particularly in steroids and spinal cord injury, and systematically sort of tells us why these studies were flawed and why the evidence is probably not there to give steroids. One being, you know, increased pulmonary complications and infection. The functional improvement that these patients had was significant from a statistical standpoint, but from a clinical standpoint, if you went from wiggling your baby finger to wiggling your thumb and your baby finger, you got a statistical improvement in your outcome, but not really a functional one. So there's a great price to pay for a small amount of benefit. The other thing is the NASIS 3 trial, which was the final sort of one that showed the two protocols for the steroids, there was no control group. There was just two trial groups. So I think, you know, that's a pretty major flaw in a randomized controlled trial.
Let's say we have a traumatized patient from an MVC who comes in with a neck seatbelt sign as opposed to abdominal seatbelt sign, with a normal CT head and no focal neurologic deficits. The majority of these patients will not have any significant blunt carotid vascular injury. How do you decide who should get vascular imaging for patients who present with a neck seatbelt sign?
We're relatively liberal with the CTA of the neck because, you know, we see a fair amount of vascular injuries. Some of them don't need anything done, but you need to be observed. Or some of them actually do need operative management. A seatbelt sign on the neck is actually one of them. Like a contusion on the skin is one of the indications. Any spinal fracture, basal skull fracture, any neurologic deficits that are not explained on your CT head. And I'll throw in one little caveat is that if you're going to do it, if there's an indication right away, for example, seatbelt sign on the neck, order, at least with our place, order the CTA neck right away. Otherwise, you have to do a CT of the C-spine and then another dose of radiation to the CTA neck. And you can actually, from the CTA neck, they can get the CT of the C-spine. So one little caveat, you'll save one sort of one CT C-spine for your patient.
Yeah, I'd agree with that in general. Not every C-spine fracture gets a CTA at our facility. Certainly if there's worry about the fracture extending into the foramen where the carotid artery is passing through, then we'll certainly do it. And I think certainly, you know, focal neurologic finding with a normal CT head is the obvious indication. But for the neurologically intact patient with a seatbelt sign, yeah, I think probably a good indication to do that test.
Here's a quick review of the neck and C-spine trauma. So first, who needs an X-ray for C-spine? Well, the Canadian C-spine rules or Nexus criteria are very good for patients with a minor mechanism of injury. On the other hand, for patients with multi-trauma who are getting a CT head anyhow, most traumatologists will go ahead and scan the neck at the same time as they scan the CT head because many studies have shown that X-rays are not sensitive enough in the severely multi-injured patient. A normal CT neck in the obtunded patient can safely have their C-spine collars removed, and when they eventually wake up in the ICU, a determination can be made at that time based on symptoms and physical exam whether they need to go on and have an MRI. There are recent guidelines that state that MR imaging is no longer required to clear the C-spine, as the negative predictive value for CT is about 99% for ligamentous injury and 100% for unstable C-spine injury. How about T and L spine? Who needs imaging there? First, it's important to remember that T-spine injuries that require operative management are quite rare. For patients who have a minor mechanism of injury and focal tenderness in the T or L spine, start with the plain film and go on to CT if the plain films are abnormal. For the trauma patient who has multiple injuries and is getting a CT thorax and abdomen anyhow, the radiologist can do 3D reconstructions for the spine, which are very good at ruling out significant T and L spine injuries. Remember that presently, there's no good evidence for methylprednisolone or steroids for spinal cord injury because there's no good clinical improvement and because there is an increased chance of secondary infection. For patients with neck seatbelt signs, while the majority of these patients will not have carotid injury, they generally should get a CTA of the neck, which should be ordered up front with the CTC spine so they don't get radiated twice. Other indications for CTA of the neck include focal neurological signs that aren't explained on the CT head, as well as basal skull fracture and some C-spine fractures. Next, we're going to talk about chest trauma. All right, let's move on to blunt chest trauma. A quick case, we got a 78-year-old woman who presents to your emergency department along with four other passengers who are on a public bus that had to stop suddenly to avoid a crash. She reports having hit the right side of her chest on the seat in front of her. Her initial vital signs are normal, and a chest X-ray reveals two rib fractures. Her abdominal exam is benign, including a negative FAST, and she's got no other injuries, let's say. How would you manage this patient, and how would you manage this patient differently than a 25-year-old patient?
I think this case is good to bring up isolated rib fractures. So first of all, I presume we've worked up for everything. I mean, anytime I see, for example, right-sided rib fractures, I want to make sure there's no liver injury. Left-sided, I'm worried about the spleen. So assuming I've ruled that out, and we decide it's just isolated rib fractures. So it is a different kettle of fish, I think, in the elderly versus the young people, specifically the elderly with lung disease, like COPD. They have high incidence of bad outcomes. Even if they look relatively well, they're generally kind of running on full capacity if they're advanced COPD. And so you throw in a couple of rib fractures, and it can sort of cause them a lot of problems. And not in the first hour. It's going to be a few hours later. I'm not sure I would necessarily jump right to admission, but I'm certainly going to watch them in the ER for a prolonged time and see how they're doing.
Would you repeat the chest X-ray in a certain amount of time?
Not necessarily. I think the more important thing is to see sort of clinically how they're doing, and are they getting a lot of pain and having a lot of trouble breathing.
Greater than 3 rib fractures in elderly patients is associated with a significant morbidity and increased mortality, I think, as well. So I think once you're, you know, above 3 rib fractures, probably looking at, you know, maybe considering admission for a little while.
So beware of rib fractures in elderly patients, especially multiple rib fractures. Multiple rib fractures in patients greater than 65 years old have a mortality 5 times as high as patients less than 65 years old. And the more rib fractures, the higher the mortality. Displaced rib fractures put patients at risk for delayed pneumothorax, and those patients should probably get a repeat chest x-ray in 3 to 6 hours. Even a simple non-displaced rib fracture can lead to atelectasis and pneumonia, especially in the elderly, if pain is not treated appropriately and good instructions for frequent deep breaths is not given. Chest x-rays can miss up to 50% of rib fractures. So next, Dr. Brzezinski and Dr. McKinnon are going to talk a little bit about using ultrasound in the ED for picking up pneumothoraces.
The other thing is nice and handy if you've got it and you can do it. This is the kind of patient that I would put the ultrasound probe on and look for a pneumothorax. You don't have to CT the patient, and it really reassures you that they don't have a small pneumo or occult pneumothorax not seen on chest x-ray.
So how does ultrasound compare to chest x-ray in terms of the specificity and sensitivity of picking up pneumothoraces?
I think it's been shown recently in the literature it's a great tool. I don't know the exact numbers, but it certainly picks up far more that you'll see on chest x-ray. We're finding now that we're CTing more patients, we're finding these occult pneumos, and you can actually see them with ultrasound pretty well too. I find it very useful in the shocky patients where you don't know what's going on. You just quickly put it on their chest and you see if they have a big pneumo even before the chest x-ray is done.
And probably the 78-year-old who at 4 hours has a tiny pneumo with a couple of rib fractures, that's probably going to be admission, and that might be your decision whether to admit or send home.
Okay. We touched on this earlier, but let's talk a little bit about chest tubes. In spontaneous pneumothoraces, they often give numbers like 3 centimeters from the apex or 15% pneumothorax. Those are the ones that require chest tubes. I mean, the trauma patient's a whole different kettle of fish. Any pneumothorax that can be seen on chest x-ray, you would put a chest tube into. Let's say you don't see a pneumothorax on the chest x-ray, but you find an occult pneumothorax on the CT. Which of those patients need chest tubes?
Yeah, I think probably most of us would watch those. If they're not intubated, not going to the OR, you could probably safely watch those. I think most of us would probably agree they're generally going to be in pretty closely monitored setting. If they deteriorate, they can always repeat the chest x-ray at some point if they need to.
I think we're at Sunnybrook doing that study right now. So anybody that's got an occult pneumo seen on CT with positive pressure ventilation going to the ICU, I believe it's randomized to chest tube or no chest tube. So I don't know that the literature has been definitively written on that topic, but certainly it's you know, it was considered heresy not to put a chest tube in before. I think we're coming around saying maybe it's not such a bad thing to do, wait and watch.
We're CTing everybody's chest now, so we're picking up a lot of these tiny pneumos that we didn't before. Which I'm sure they all did fine. We didn't have a rash of tension pneumothoraces, you know, at times. So.
Yeah, I guess the other, just to mention again, the caveat about, you know, if the patient has multiple problems and the last thing you want is them to develop a tension pneumothorax and then you got to put a chest tube in. If they've got other injuries which may cause hypotension or cause them to be unstable, you might just want to put the chest tube in on a sort of quote-unquote prophylactic basis, just to make sure that that is out of the equation and then you know that that's not the reason they're crashing.
I'm a fan of putting in the chest tubes really high. I go nipple level or higher. This whole thing about putting the chest tube really low to sort of facilitate drainage, not really a big fan of that. I think you just risk them going under the diaphragm. And most of these patients, while they have their chest tube, most of them are supine anyway. They're not up walking around in the first couple of days anyway.
So there's a little pearl I picked up in Australia was the Brits and the Aussies talk a lot about this triangle of safety. It's actually a great little study one of the residents did there, and he took a picture of a guy with his arm up and he's laying on a stretcher, and he asked from medical students all the way up to consultants, he said, put an X on the chest where you think you should put the chest tube. And he got a whole pile of X's all over the place. And there's, if you look it up, you Google the triangle of safety, it shows the proper placement for a chest tube is one, above the nipple line, like you say, between the nipple line and the axilla, and then anterior to latissimus dorsi, so you're avoiding the long thoracic nerve, and then medial to the, or posterior to the pectoralis muscle. So it's a nice little easy way to remember where to put the chest tube.
So ED bedside ultrasound is great for diagnosing pneumothoraces. In fact, the sensitivity is about 98%, while the specificity is 99% for pneumothorax compared with CT. If you look at the sensitivity for chest X-ray for pneumothoraces compared to CT, it's only 75%. Remember that a pneumothorax can often be absent on the initial chest X-ray, so some experts suggest repeating the chest X-ray to detect a delayed pneumothorax. What about these occult pneumothoraces that can be seen on CT or ultrasound but not on chest X-ray? Currently, the evidence suggests that probably observing these patients with high-flow oxygen is pretty safe, and that you can avoid having to put in a chest tube for these occult pneumothoraces. Next, we're going to talk about abdominal and pelvic trauma. We've talked a bit about head, neck, spine, and chest trauma. Let's move on to blunt abdominal and pelvic trauma. Why is the abdomen so important to evaluate thoroughly in trauma? Well, the failure to appropriately evaluate the abdomen has been identified as the most common significant error in trauma management, which often leads to catastrophic outcomes. So let's throw a case in here. You're the ED doc in a small community hospital, and a 25-year-old woman, front passenger in an MVC, arrives in severe hemorrhagic shock and decreased level of consciousness with an abdominal seatbelt sign. When you get to the examination of the bony pelvis, you gently put compression on the iliac crests, and they seem like they're mobile. What are some of the more subtle clues of a pelvic fracture or an unstable pelvic fracture that we should be looking out for?
Clinical exam. So what you've already done is just gently pushing on the pelvis. And they talk about, you know, the proper way. Start with pressure from the outside, and then if that's stable, then you move in. I mean, I'm not sure that has a big effect, but yeah, you should probably be careful when you're examining the pelvis. I think of a couple patients with hematoma in sort of the groin, and of course that makes you more specifically worry about an arterial injury in the pelvis, like an arterial bleed with a pelvis fracture, which of course we worry about a lot more, be unstable quicker. I think any other ecchymosis that you're seeing, if you sort of consider your fast part of your physical exam, I mean, if you're seeing fluid in the pelvis, you're worried about a pelvis injury.
You'll blood at the penile meatus and large scrotal hematoma. I'll take it one step backwards and say even, you know, mechanisms of injury. So you got a guy, a driver, that's T-bone on the driver's side. I'm thinking lateral compression, pelvic injury right off the bat, or somebody that's fallen off a building and land on their one leg. You know, they've got a vertical shear until proven otherwise. Another point about examining the pelvis is one person does it, and then it's always exciting when you find that unstable, mechanically unstable pelvis, like, hey, come on over and feel this. And so that's not the right thing to do. One person does it, and then if it's deemed unstable, then we immobilize it. And most of the time, that's, you know, an open book type pelvic fracture. We'll put a sheet around and immobilize a patient.
So why is it especially important to recognize pelvic fractures early on?
Well, you're going to get potential for a lot of bleeding, and then that's the real main issue. I think the primary cause of mortality from pelvic fractures. Now, remember, there's bleeding from three sources in the pelvic fractures. It's the venous plexus of the pelvic brim, which probably is the most responsible culprit for the bleeding. There's also bleeding from the cancellous bone. And in about 5% of the time, it's an arterial bleed from one of the branches of the internal iliacs.
One of the reasons I think you want to recognize it early is because looking ahead at the management, really hard to stop that bleeding. A trauma laparotomy, packing the pelvis does not do very much. Sort of latest literature is saying that external fixation doesn't really do a lot. In the patient you're worried about, in the unstable patient, it's very often in that 5% with the arterial bleed. And so putting an external fixation doesn't really splint that artery per se. So angio's really been the way to go. I mean, we've been more liberal with angio in the last few years now. And so the one problem with angio is it's really hard to set up. It's not available in 5 or 10 minutes like the OR. They've got to get a whole team in. They've got to, you know, if it's evening or nighttime, they're not there. They got to get people in from home, warm up all the equipment. So you're looking at, you know, a good 45 minutes would be quick if you can get it that quick. So that's why I want, is because I want to activate the angio team pretty quickly if I'm worried the patient's really unstable and that seems to be their main injury.
Let's say you were advising the small community eMERGE doc about this patient. What would you tell them about the immediate management of this potentially unstable pelvic fracture?
So ABCs, make sure everybody's secure or if they need to be. Jump to C. I mean, I think the patient, make sure they've got a couple large bore IVs at least and good venous access. And probably immobilization of the pelvis. It's not appropriate in all scenarios, but for most, we want to immobilize. It's not necessarily compressed. So if you have a lateral compression injury, you don't really necessarily need to tighten the pelvis up anymore, but you just want to immobilize it. The open book is the one where you want to reduce the volume of the pelvic space so that there's essentially trying to tamp and add the bleeding. A little point about that is most people just use a sheet. The placement of the sheet is often not in the right place. So you want to actually go around the greater trochanters and then tie the sheet in the front as tightly as you can using some surgical clips if you have that available. Or if you have a proper pelvic binder, that's another option to go. But it's lower than you'd think. It's over the greater trochanter that you want to apply the...
It's a good point, because when you examine, we're pushing mostly on the ASIS, and so that's where people think you'd put the sheet, but you're absolutely right. It's lower. It's the greater trochanters, just the most effective way. So we actually have pelvic binders, just basically a fancy version of a sheet.
Okay, and then what are some of the key things you're looking for on the pelvic x-ray? Do you have any sort of pearls for interpreting pelvic x-rays?
That's a tricky one, because as far as I know, there's not a huge correlation between what you see on your x-ray and the hemodynamic status of your patient. You can have a very minimal pubic ramus fracture and you nick the obturator artery and you're exsanguinating from that pelvic fracture. In broad terms, my sort of general classification is it's by mechanism of injury. It's the Young-Burgess classification. So lateral compression injuries. So you're looking for basically, you know, lateral fracture patterns, an AP or open book type pelvic fracture. And I'm not sure the details are all that important, but, you know, if there's, in general, the wider the symphysis is open, the more risk of other associated injuries and hemorrhage. And then the vertical shear. As far as predicting angiography, this is there's a ton of literature on this problem. And there, as far as I know, there's no specific correlation between your risk of hemorrhage that's very sensitive or specific and the finding on a pelvic x-ray.
So, of course, angiography is generally considered useful for arterial bleeding, for venous bleeding. I mean, you can't angio a vein per se. So what I find with these pelvic injuries, luckily, only 5% are arterial, so which are the ones we kind of really worry about. The venous bleeding, it's really one of those injuries where it does tend to sort of tampen that off. You put the sheet, you sort of wrap the pelvis, start to give them some saline, at some point maybe some blood, and then they kind of seem to stabilize. Bring them up to CT, like if they're stable enough, bring them to CT. You don't see any arterial blush, so you're kind of happy. It's just the venous. So luckily for those in the periphery, you know, you wrap the pelvis, send them with some fluids and blood, and you kind of just hope that it's not a bad arterial bleed. There's not much you can do. It's one, you know, your surgeon can't do anything about this. And like I said, packing the pelvis doesn't stop the bad arterial bleed. So it's not something you want to rush to the OR. Send them to your trauma center as quickly as you can. If they're one of those 5% with a bad arterial bleed, get them to angio as quick as you can.
Look, if you've got a pelvic fracture, I think you need to assess the abdomen as well. So we kind of prioritize whether you think the bleeding's in the abdomen or in the pelvis. So if your FAST is negative or there's really a minimal amount of free fluid in the abdomen, then you prioritize the pelvis. And if it's grossly unstable, obviously you want to mechanically close the pelvis. And hopefully you can get the patient stable enough to go to CT. And I think a lot of your decisions from there on depends on what you find on CT. So you mentioned arterial blush. If there's an arterial blush, you're probably going to go to angiography first.
Can you just explain what arterial blush is for our listeners?
Yeah, so when you do your CT of your abdomen and pelvis, you're injecting contrast. And what you're seeing is that contrast being extravasated from a ruptured vessel. So it looks like a big white blotch in the...
And specifically an artery, not a vein.
Correct.
So ruptured, a venous bleeding, you don't get blush. That's
correct.
Kind of the key point.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there's a couple of rare patients that you can't find their site of bleeding on CT scan, but they're still hypotensive. And the thought is that perhaps they're so hypotensive, you're not getting the circulation that will express the blush and let you see that blush. So that may even be a patient that you're going to want to angiography or angio as well. But that would probably occur from the critical care unit. There's a couple papers as well that have shown that the size of the retroperitoneal hematoma is predictive of arterial bleeding too. So again, if you do the scan and you don't see a blush, but they've got an enormous retroperitoneal hematoma and they're unstable, that might be also a patient you might decide, well, better go and have a look at the arteries and make sure that there's no arterial bleeding.
The other thing to think about, if you're fairly sure there's a bad bleed in the pelvis and maybe the fast in the abdomen didn't look that bad, with angio, they can actually embolize the spleen and the liver potentially. So just keep that in mind. That's an option that if you think, again, it's a little bit of a guessing game and you're going to do this in conjunction with your surgeon.
Let's say you have a patient with abdominal trauma who has a maybe sort of a faint seatbelt sign with a negative fast exam. Let's just talk a little bit about the fast exam and the pitfalls of the fast exam. Which patients with a negative fast exam should you be worried about and go on to CT?
I think the one thing to think about the fast exam, or one thing to remember about it, it's a rule-in exam. It's not a rule-out exam. Its biggest benefit is in the hypotensive patient, and you want to see whether you need to go right to the OR. And you get your positive fast, you kind of have your answer. Bypass CT, go right to the OR. So you get a negative fast exam. Then you've basically got to decide. So your question is, who do you need to work up then at that point? So I think, again, you're going back to your mechanism of injury, their symptoms. Do they actually have abdominal pain? Do they actually have abdominal tenderness on exam? And if they do and they have a significant mechanism, you really got to work that up. You're probably going to have to go to CT scan.
You can miss free fluid in the belly on your fast exam. So this is borne out by the studies that originally looked at CT versus even DPL and fast. The good news is that the sensitivity of FAST was something that I can't remember in studies, but around 80%. But if you looked at the number of FAST that missed free fluid when there was a surgical indication, the sensitivity goes up to 99%. So you're not going to miss a significant bleed on your FAST exam. But at the same time, you're not going to rule out intra-abdominal injury with a FAST. And I think that's one thing that I see more junior house staff or clinicians say, I'm just going to do a quick FAST on this patient. If it's normal, I'm going to send them home. Well, that doesn't rule out intra-abdominal injury. Now, you mentioned a patient's got a seatbelt sign. These are injuries that are going to be, what quote-unquote, again, occult. Things like duodenal hematomas, pancreatic injuries, small bowel injuries, things that don't bleed a lot, or mesenteric injuries. They don't bleed a lot, but they cause problems later down the road. So the patient gets septic in the ICU because they've got a bowel perforation. The good news to this story is that most of the time on CT nowadays, the CTs are so sensitive that these occult injuries are no longer becoming so occult and that we're usually finding something associated with them. So, yeah, a very good point. FAST is not the be-all and end-all and does not rule out intra-abdominal injury, particularly in that scenario.
Okay, let's say you do move on to a CT. What are some key injuries that CT misses?
Well, I mean, like Mike was saying, they're pretty good these days. They still will miss smaller bowel injuries, which generally, in fact, quite often, actually don't need any operative management. They just kind of need to be observed, and most of them do fine. Small pancreatic injuries.
Diaphragm is always the bugbear as well these days. So small diaphragmatic injuries are kind of missed. You have to be careful as well that not all CT scans are created equal, and you have to have your clinical suspicion guide the protocol that you're going to use for your CT. For example, penetrating trauma. If you've got a stab wound to the flank or back, that's a patient's going to need what we used to call triple contrast, now double contrast, but it's going to need rectal contrast as well to look for that retroperitoneal colonic injury. You may want to do a delayed scan if you're suspicious of a ureteric injury. So you give the contrast, and then 15 minutes later, you do another scan to look at the ureters and see if there's any extravasation. So I think it's not all that simple. Duodeno, a pancreatic injury, sometimes we'll give a little bit of oral contrast, have them drink it while they're doing the scan to better visualize that area.
Here's the review of abdominal and pelvic trauma. It's important to recognize pelvic fractures early because pelvic ring disruptions are associated with a mortality as high as 50%, mostly because of massive hemorrhage from fractured bone, direct arterial injury, and damage to the extensive pelvic venous plexus. Also, it's important to remember that in those patients that you suspect might have arterial injury, it's important to get angiography early. This takes time to activate. So to help you diagnose pelvic fractures early, here are some clinical clues. First, think about the mechanism. For example, if it's a fall from a great height, you'll suspect a pelvic fracture immediately. On the physical exam, you should be looking for groin and or suprapubic swelling or bruising, tenderness of the symphysis pubis, a palpable defect at the symphysis, peripheral neuropathy might give you a clue that there's a pelvic fracture, and on the FAST, you should be looking for fluid in the pelvis. Then there's the classic blood at the meatus and scrotal hematoma, which would increase your suspicion that there's a pelvic fracture. Remember that when assessing for pelvic stability, you want to apply gentle compression to the iliac crest. Do not rock the pelvis. So for patients who you suspect have an open book pelvic fracture, you want to minimize the venous bleeding. And the easiest way to do this is by applying a sheet over the greater trochanters or using a pelvic binder if you have one. Scott Weingart from emcrit.org describes a great way to assess and treat pelvic instability. He says, on any blunt trauma patient, the pelvis should be assessed by one inward squeeze at the level of the greater trochanters. If there is inward movement, do not release your grip. Keep inward pressure on the trochanters and have an assistant wrap a sheet around your hands and pull as tight as their strength will allow. Only when the sheet is about to be fully tightened should you remove your hands. Remember that you also want to bind the lower thighs and ankles together using appropriate padding. The bed sheet should be folded longitudinally. It's eased under the pelvis and then applied circumferentially with gradual tightening and maybe twisted once around itself to achieve secure compression. The sheet should then be fastened with clamps. It's important also to remember that any wrinkling of the sheet during the placement is no good because this can increase the risk of pressure ulcers. What about the pelvic X-ray? Please look at our written summary for a good classification system for looking at pelvic X-rays. Remember that the wider the symphysis, the more likely that there will be a bad bleed. Otherwise, the pelvic X-ray really has poor correlation with the degree of bleeding. Other predictors of arterial bleeding are blush on the CT and a large size of retroperitoneal hematoma. Some pearls about the bedside ultrasound or FAST exam in the trauma patient. The FAST exam has most benefit in shocky patients with a positive FAST who go straight to the OR. If the FAST is negative and there's a worrisome mechanism, you still need to go on to CT. FAST can miss free fluid that's under about 200 cc's. The FAST can miss bowel hematomas, mesenteric injuries, pancreatic injuries, and diaphragmatic injuries. However, it is good to know that the sensitivity of FAST for surgically significant bleeds is in the high 90s. Well, if the FAST misses a bunch of injuries, what about the CT? It can miss pancreatic injuries and it can miss small diaphragmatic injuries. Remember when you're ordering a CT for a trauma patient to use double contrast for penetrating injuries and consider delayed contrast if you want to rule out ureteric injuries. Next, we're going to talk about penetrating extremity trauma. Let's move on to penetrating extremity trauma. We've been talking up until now really strictly about blunt trauma. In Canada, we see a lot less penetrating trauma than in the States, for example. So here's a case. A young man was minding his own business when he was stabbed in the thigh with a switchblade. His friends immediately drove him to hospital, and he walks into your triage limping. His vital signs are normal. On his lower extremity exam, you find a 2 to 3 centimeter laceration in the lateral thigh with blood slowly oozing out of the wound. His neurovascular exam is normal with pedal pulses present, and a handheld Doppler revealed equal pulses bilaterally. How would you manage this patient?
The first thing that I would look at is the location of the injury and proximity to the vessel. And proximity used to be an indication for angiography, but now it's pretty much gone by the wayside. And so if it's not near the vessel, I think you're much more reassured. It's not to say that you can't have a vascular injury. And I think that's where you rely more on your quote-unquote hard signs and things like, you know, expanding hematomas, active arterial bleeding from the wound, peripheral pulses that are absent or diminished, motor sensory changes in the distal extremity. Most people would either explore those or angio or CTA them nowadays.
And, I was just going to make that point. So CTA, I think, has really changed these because early in my training, you had to get angiography for these. It's really hard to get, and you're not going to get it in the evening or overnight if they have a pulse. That used to be the general kind of consensus. So, I mean, I think as a result, harder tests to get, I think we probably missed a lot of these small arterial injuries that went on, you know, aneurysms or rupture, or, you know, ischemic legs and things like that. I think with the advent of CTA, which, you know, again, CTs these days, really good, get a really good picture. I think our threshold for doing those, you probably agree, Mike, is just a lot lower.
The bigger question is if you're in a setting that doesn't have a CTA that's readily available, how are you going to decide? And, you know, I think the older tests that we use are more difficult, cumbersome to use, and probably not as reliable. Things like differential pulse pressures in a wound that's not near a vessel and you have a normal neurologic and neurovascular exam in that distal extremity, you can probably wait. And if you're still worried, you can probably send the patient down to a center at some point in the absence of hard signs.
Yeah, and I certainly feel, I mean, I've worked in, you know, smaller hospitals, and it's a tough sell, you know. Mm. You know, other end of the phone, you're hearing, you know what, the guy's got a pulse and you want to send him down.
Right, so one of the things you can do is an ABI. Can you just describe how to do an ABI?
Basically, you're taking the pressure in the upper extremity and the injured lower extremity and comparing the ratio. And if the difference is greater than 10%, the systolic pressure in the lower extremity is about 90% or greater, you can be somewhat reassured. Or even, I think it depends on where your threshold is. 95% is probably more likelihood there's no injury in that lower extremity.
I guess it's just in that case where you're in a small community and you're trying to convince the receiving doctor to transfer them. You could do an ABI and say, look, it's really...
I mean, if you get an abnormal one, I think you're stuck if it's normal. Certainly wouldn't rely on it. Normal ABI, you're not sending them home if you're worried.
I think a note to be made of high-velocity injuries. They're a different kettle of fish than your handgun injuries or your stab wounds. So they cause a great deal of cavitation, and the potential for vascular injuries is far greater, and also for shotgun injuries. So you've got massive pellets everywhere. I think that it's almost a no-brainer, slam dunk, got to get a CTA on those patients to make sure there's no vascular injury.
So the major pitfall in penetrating extremity trauma is reliance on a Dopplerable pulse to rule out vascular injury. The femoral artery is the most commonly injured vessel. When it comes to vascular injury, it's good to know the hard signs of vascular injury and the soft signs of vascular injury. The hard signs, which have a 100% positive predictive value for vascular injury requiring the OR, are 1. Severe active bleeding, 2. Shock, 3. Large palpable expanding or pulsatile hematoma, 4. A palpable thrill or audible bruit, and 5, distal ischemia, based on the 6 P's. The soft signs for vascular injury are a small, stable hematoma, minor bleeding, proximity to major vessels, and adjacent nerve injury. If your patient has soft signs of vascular injury, then do a CTA and go from there. In the next segment, Dr. McKinnon and Dr. Bukowski are going to review the transfer of the trauma patient from a community hospital to a trauma hospital. Okay, let's talk a little bit about transferring the trauma patient from the community hospital to a trauma center. What should the priorities of management be for the traumatized patient who's being transferred to a trauma center?
As we do in emergency medicine with everything, I think you start with the ABC. So you've got to look at the airway, and this patient's going to be transferred. Look at how long they're going to be transferred. And I think you've got to make a call on whether they need to be intubated beforehand or not. In general, I think probably the rule is you'd have a slightly lower threshold to intubate in the periphery if you have a transfer, because you're not going to be watching that patient as closely. And even if you are, even if you go in the ambulance with a patient, that's really difficult en route. Not a very good controlled setting to intubate in. You don't have all the extra difficult airway equipment. So probably the main caveat about the airway. Make sure they have adequate IV access. If you need, you're going to bring fluids for sure. Consider bringing blood if you think you have a chance you might need it. Just bring it along. In terms of workup at the original center, I think it depends on which sort of patient we're talking about. If we're talking about the really sick patient you just laid eyes on and in 5 seconds you know right away this patient's got to go to a trauma center because of mechanism or their condition, I think probably all you really need is a chest x-ray, maybe a pelvis x-ray, but a chest x-ray for sure. Put in the chest tubes if you need it, because again, transfer, you don't want to send somebody with a develop a tension pneumothorax en route. Pelvis x-ray, you could argue if it's unstable, just wrap a sheet around it or put a pelvic binder.
If you're transferring into a trauma center, what's the expected blood work to be done at the originating center?
Oh, Mike and I are going to love this question. The answer is nothing. If you think they need to be sent, you need a chest x-ray, vital signs, and bundle the patient up.
Maybe a pelvic x-ray, too, if you're suspicious. But look, yeah, I agree. The less, the better. If you can identify something that tells you, I've got to transfer this patient to a trauma center. And the statement I get from physicians working in the community, and look, I have a lot of respect for them because they don't have the resources we have, but they'll sometimes tell us, but you guys wanted me to prove that the patient needed to come to a center like yours. But I think if the patient has a pelvic fracture, they got a significant chest injury, a head injury, penetrating truncal trauma, those are all pretty clear indications that need to be transferred. So don't bother doing any other tests. I mean, if you want to do a CBC, that's fine while you're waiting for the helicopter or the ambulance, that's fine. I agree, a chest x-ray, probably a pelvis x-ray. Forget about any CT scans. Don't do a C-spine because we're gonna scan it anyway if it's blood trauma. And I know the intentions are probably very good if there are CT scans initiated in the periphery. This is a scenario where, I know the patient's going to be transferred. I'm kind of worried about their spine or their chest or something. I'm just going to get a CAT scan done at my facility and then send the patient. I would strongly discourage that practice. If you know you're going to send the patient anyway, we're going to do all the scans anyways, and our protocols are probably a bit different than some peripheral hospitals where they may not do the recon formats in the peripheral hospital. So just another dig in there for, please, if you're going to transfer patients, don't bother with the scanning. We'll do it all.
And I remember I gave a talk on sort of trauma in the non-trauma setting, and one of the sort of studies I quoted was looking at patients getting re-CT'd. And basically, it was about 50% of the time what the CTs done in the periphery were repeated. Very, very high. I mean, you could go through all the different ones. So the CT head, so our neurosurgeons, they want the most current CT head to make their decision. So even if there was a bleed an hour or two ago in the periphery, they want to see what it is now, because maybe it's stable and they don't have to operate, or maybe it's worse. So they end up doing a CT head again anyway. In terms of the thorax abdo-pelvis, we clear our T and L spines mainly with a CT now. And if you get a CT from the periphery, our system, we can't do the recons of the T and L spine. And so we have to rescan that anyway. So I very much encourage, for sure, do not do the CT. I'd say, you know, definitely a chest x-ray, because you need to know if you need to put in a chest tube before you send them. That's a nice simple thing you should be doing there in the periphery if you need to. You know, pelvis x-ray plus or minus, a lot of would argue, if it feels unstable, just wrap a sheet. That's all you're going to do anyway. If it doesn't feel unstable, even if there's a fracture, you're fine just to send them anyway. Maybe the last thing I'd say, this is the rare patient that's really unstable. If you can do a fast, and I think most ERs in the periphery now have sort of capability to do a fast in the ED. If you have the really unstable patient, let's say they've ruptured their spleen, well, and you have surgery at your site, that's the rare case that probably your surgeons should be coming to see and see if they want to, it shouldn't be a splenectomy, but do a damage control laparotomy before you send that patient. Because it might be 2 or 3 hours before they get onto our operating table with all the transfer time and everything. And that might not be enough time. There's the rare patient that will bleed out very quickly and die in the first hour or two. And so it's just important to recognize that sort of case, do your fast and call your surgeon and say, I've got the trauma center I've talked to. They're going to accept. One of the key things is when I get, it's very rare, but I'll tell that ER physician, I'm happy to accept that patient for sure. We have the bed, because I think the surgeon in the periphery feels a lot more comfortable. They know there's a bed to go to after, because they're, you know, complex care, and there's probably other injuries as well, but they probably really should have a trauma laparotomy before they come.
Yeah, that's a pretty rare case.
That's a rare case, but it's important to know about, because you don't want to send that patient and have them die en route.
A couple of the things I think you need to consider is, like you mentioned, the distance and how long the patient's going to be en route. And if you have an option of either transferring by land or air, it's often difficult to decide. I think my general rule of thumb is if it's going to take an hour and a half or less by land, it's probably more efficient if you have an ambulance available to do it by land. If it's greater than that time period, then the helicopter becomes more efficient. And that's just a ballpark figure that we've sort of kind of recognized the fact that it does take time for the helicopter to get activated and get up to the site scene. Of course, we're at the mercy of weather, and people don't sort of remember all these other things, non-medical issues like, you know, is it snowing out? Is there a thunderstorm going on? The helicopter can't land. So all those things are you need to sort of take into consideration. And personnel, you mentioned too, you want to have the person with adequate skills that's going to be able to intervene on this particular patient. You have to try to weigh all these different variables into making your decision on how to safely transfer this patient.
There was a lot of literature coming out of the U.S. in the late 90s about unsafe helicopter transfers. And I think when you actually dig through the literature, there were a lot of crashes, and they started to question. So now you have a patient and usually two personnel that died trying to save a life, and they looked at how beneficial is helicopter transfer versus this risk of crashes. One of the issues in the States is that it was becoming a bit of a business. These are companies, privately owned companies, that want to do as many transfers as they want, and that really sort of changed the scales a little bit in that. They were being really aggressive of trying to do air transport for everybody, even in bad weather. There's financial pressures for you to try to do the transfer. At the time, I talked to a couple of Orange physicians, whose Orange is, of course, our air medical transport in Ontario, and they said it's very, very different here. They have very strict rules about when they can and can't. One interesting thing, here they actually don't get the description of the patient. So you don't want to hear that, you know, it's poor little tiny Tim who fell off a horse, is really injured. They don't want any emotion in the decision. It's strictly, is it safe or not for me to fly in this weather condition? And then they have very strict guidance. They have to actually, at nighttime, they have to land on a proper helipad here. So they won't land on the highway here at nighttime.
One sort of pet peeve of mine is that often we'll get patients who have been on their backboards for hours from the time of their injury. And the argument is, well, they may have a spine injury. That argument doesn't fly. I mean, I would get these patients off of the backboards, preventing decubitus ulcers as well. It's very uncomfortable for the patients. The fact that you're transferring the patient doesn't mean you need to keep them on the backboard forever. And even if they do have a spine fracture, we use spinal precautions. I mean, they can be on a mattress and not moving, and they're not going to cause any damage to any spinal injury. So it's a bit of a misnomer that the spine board is mandatory for somebody that you suspect has got a spine fracture, particularly in a long, long transfer time.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So every hospital, whether peripheral or trauma center hospital, should have a protocol where the patients on backboards should be seen immediately. You know, even if it's a more minor injury, they should just be seen immediately and log rolled off the backboard. Because, yeah, I've seen that too, where in a really sick patient, they come into a peripheral hospital and they think, oh, this patient's going to be transferred in 30 minutes, so I'm not going to bother taking them off the backboard. But I think it's important to really, once you've stabilized the ABCs, get them off the backboard, because the transfer might be delayed. And
I agree. Yeah, I'm 100% with it. And it just, you know, use the board for transfer, then take it, you know, I agree, take it out. I mean, what do we do when we get to the scanner and they have a T10 fracture? We put them on a soft hospital.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the next thing you do. So
please, if you can, and of course, time is the determinant of some of these things, but a patient has a badly displaced fracture or dislocation, I think you do your best to try to reduce that if it's going to be a long transport time. So not only uncomfortable for the patient, but it's probably bad for the tissues. And if you can splint them. So the other thing is that you mentioned tib-fib fractures and open tib-fib fractures. I think also we really underestimate the amount of bleeding that these things can have. You're in an ambulance for 2 hours and the patient comes off the stretcher and there's pools of blood under these open fractures. So just keep bear in mind that there are some of those sort of slower blood loss sites.
Next, Dr. McKinnon is going to talk about whether NG tubes are necessary for patients who are being transferred to a trauma center.
I do not think they're necessary, except I think if somebody's been intubated, and especially if they've been bagged a lot before, which often trauma patients have, you'll often see on your chest x-ray a huge gastric bubble. But even if they don't, I think if you intubate them, now they're sedated, go ahead and put an NG tube in.
Yeah,
it's pretty harmless.
Yeah.
Decompress the stomach.
The caveat to that is if they've got a significant facial smash.
Well, then you put, NG, I guess, a gastric tube. So you put an oral gastric in. Mm-hmm. You know,
so
just get your laryngoscope, and right after you tube them, just throw in the OG or an NG if you think it's safe.
You know, there's that one picture of that coiled NG tube in the anterior cranial fossa, which I think should have been thrown out and forgotten long ago. I think it's overrated. And basal skull fracture is only if you've got like anterior cranial vault disruption in the cribriform plate.
I mean, this is
a pretty specific, unusual injury. And even so, if you properly put in the NG tube in, you could probably go straight back and not have too much of a concern about it. But you know, people say, gee, he's got blood coming from his ear, he's got a basal skull fracture, I can't put an NG tube in. That's complete garbage.
No, I think that's garbage. Yeah, it's a facial. But I must say, any suspicion of facial, I mean, I'm not. And if they're tubed, you have the laryngoscope, sure. You're right there. Just put an OG
in. Yeah, I agree. I go orgastric with that.
But put something in.
But I think patients should also have a Foley catheter as well. That's sort of one thing that doesn't often get missed. But
the other one, though, I'd like to bring up is lacerations.
Yes.
You need to sew lacerations, and Mike just talked about the patient arriving with the open tip fib, and there's a big pool of blood, and usually these patients are polytraumatized. We don't know where the internal bleeding is. It's nice and simple. Scalp lax can bleed a lot. Give it a quick clean, slap in some staples in the scalp. Even if you had an open tip fib, and if you had an open tip fib that was bleeding profusely, forget about the old ortho has to close it in the OR. They're transferred for 2 hours. You got to just give it a clean as best you can with some saline. You got to throw some sutures to stop that bleeding.
Yeah,
they can open it back up and clean it after. But
the scalp lax, I like if it's sometimes really macerated and difficult to staple, then I just throw locking sutures in. So you do a locking stitch and does a fantastic job of hemostasis of a big nylon.
Sure.
So I'm just going to review transferring the patient to the trauma center now. Have a low threshold to intubate patients when you know that they're going to be in transfer for a long time. You don't want them to run into trouble during the transfer. For very sick patients who need to be transferred, do a chest x-ray to see if there's a pneumothorax. If there is one, put a chest tube in. And consider a pelvic x-ray if you're suspicious of a fracture. Some would argue that you can skip the pelvic x-ray, and if the patient is in shock and you suspect that there's an open book pelvic fracture, that you tie with a sheet. Don't do CTs at the peripheral hospital if they're being transferred, because often this will delay definitive management. If the patient's very unstable with a hugely positive fast, and they may have a ruptured spleen, let's say, consider getting your local surgeon to do a damage control laparotomy before transfer. This is the rare situation where you might get your local surgeon involved in conjunction with transfer to the trauma center after a damage control laparotomy is done. In terms of deciding to transfer a patient by land or air, the ballpark rule of thumb is if it's 90 minutes or less that it will take by land, then use a land ambulance. If you suspect that it'll be greater than 90 minutes by land, then air transfer might be a better option. Of course, you need to take into account things like weather conditions and the time of day. Don't forget to log roll patients off backboards as soon as possible. Backboards are for transferring only. For patients where you have a few minutes before the transfer, try and reduce obviously displaced fractures and dislocations, stop bleeding of open fractures and scalp lacerations, and consider an NG for intubated patients or an OG for intubated patients with significant facial injury. As well, if you have time, put in a Foley catheter. Next, we're going to talk about pen scanning, which is CTing the trauma patient from head right down to the pelvis. One last question before we go is, where do you stand on the pan scan approach to major trauma patient? Well, there's one study in particular that showed that pan scanning resulted in a change in management in 20% of patients. And the study that also showed that it picked up an additional injury in 17% of patients compared to a focused CT use. A single abdominal CT can increase the chance of lethal cancer by around 1 in 2,000, on the other hand. And there's also been estimates of unnecessary imaging for trauma patients that's in the price range of about $17 billion a year just in the U.S. So where do you stand on pan scanning for the major trauma patient? Should they be pan scanned or should we be sticking with focused CT use?
Can I go for me first?
Yeah, go.
I think Mike and I are both ready to jump on this one. So I actually presented that paper at one of our trauma rounds as well. And I think it might be one of the most dangerous papers out there where you can sort of twist numbers. When you really look at it, and I mean, a lot of people have said this about the paper, Their change in managements were trivial, probably didn't mean anything. Didn't really say whether they actually examined and determined the patient, a physical exam, and seen who they would have scanned anyway. They just kind of blindly did this pan scan, and now it's sort of, some degree, it's, you know, it's becoming a bit accepted, which scares me a little bit. I talked a little bit before, I think maybe the one scan we can avoid a lot, or is not necessary a lot of the time, is a CT of the chest. If we're not worried about the aorta on mechanism, we're going to see any hemopneumothorax on chest x-ray. What do we really care about? Rib fractures. So if you're not worried about the aorta or the T-spine, you're going to see everything else you need to on the chest x-ray. But anyway, just getting back to that study then, I think a lot of those minor, and even in the one that showed, you know, an extra, we picked up all these other injuries, you know, they were minor things. They were rib fractures. They were trivial pneumothoraces, which now they're studying whether we even need to do anything with these. So
just to talk about the chest CT for one, there was a New England Journal article, I believe, about a couple of years ago, and it was about blunt aortic injury. And some of the recommendations there were absurd. They said if you're in a motor vehicle accident of greater than 10 miles per hour, you could have a blunt aortic injury. There's that sort of literature that's making us all paranoid and saying, yeah, you can have a normal chest x-ray and have an aortic injury. I mean, that's extreme. I think one of the problems with not pan scanning is, as trauma team leaders, we're not the ones who are responsible for going back and doing serial examinations of the abdomen. So I've got an alert and oriented patient that has a significant mechanism of injury, normal vital signs, and I'm in a peripheral setting and I don't have a CAT scanner. What am I going to do? Well, I'm either going to transfer the patient or I'm going to keep the patient, do serial vital signs, maybe serial hemoglobins and serial examinations. But the surgeons, and I don't blame them, but they don't want to have that responsibility of going back for 24 hours and examine this patient over and over and over. I'd rather just do a scan and find out there's no bleeding, and now I can rest assured and I can sleep at night. So I think part of it is the fact that we don't want to use our clinical judgment. And in some cases, of course, clinical judgment is pretty unreliable, for example, with the abdomen. We probably should be a little more selective in our approach to pan scanning, but at the same time, we are the end of the line. We're the last resource that's going to look at this patient and rule out injury.
There are so many factors into this. It's all the pressures to sort of do these scans and rule them out. Let's say you have a patient, I'll just give you an example, an MVC, and they come in and they have basically abdominal pain and maybe pelvis pain, and they've got a little pelvis fracture, and you CT their abdomen. And they go upstairs and somebody says, well, did you clear their C-spine? You say, well, yeah, they had no neck pain, and I examined it, and they moved it around, and they had no pain, and I cleared them clinically. And then you sort of get the old, well, they had a pelvis fracture and a spleen injury and a rupture, and you didn't rule out a C-spine fracture. And so anyway, there's all kinds of pressures from different sources, and some people think if they have one injury, you've got to just suddenly rule out every single injury in their body. And I don't know, it's taken a little bit away from clinical judgment.
Right.
And I think maybe, again, as I said before, you might not know the full effect of this for 20 or 30 years.
Agreed. I mentioned this before, but I practiced in Australia a couple of years ago for a year, and their approach was very different. And when I suggested you should scan this patient head to toe, I got these radiologists would call me and say, what are you doing? So their approach was very different. And it was, if you're intubated, you got a pan scan. If you're unable to clinically judge patients' conditions, you got a pan scan. So obtunded, intubated patients all got it. The others, which were alert, and even if they had distracting injuries, they would not pan scan, but they would do more use of plain film, so for C-spines, they would do that, and they would do more selective imaging like you suggest, so do either a chest or an abdomen or a head and serial examination. So there are different cultures around the world that have different philosophies towards this.
Ooh, what a wonderful world it's gonna be.
And for this month's quote of the month, I'd like to give you something from Jessica Stern, which gives you a little bit of an idea of what it might be like for our trauma patients. Some people's lives seem to flow in a narrative. Mine had many stops and starts. That's what trauma does. It interrupts the plot. You can't process it because it doesn't fit with what came before or what comes afterward. A friend of mine put it this way. In most of our lives, most of the time, you have a sense of what is to come. There is a steady narrative, a feeling of lights, camera, action when big events are imminent. But trauma isn't like that. It just happens. And then life goes on. No one prepares you for it.
Very good. No, this was fun.
Yeah,
thanks very much. And Anton, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up this episode, I just want to announce that Emergency Medicine Cases is available now on iTunes. So if you go to iTunes and in the search box, you just put Emergency Medicine Cases podcast, will come up as the first result, and just click on it and enjoy. And until next time, take it easy.